Hello and welcome back. In the previous lecture, we saw how the Roman religious system increasingly fell under the influence of its Greek counterpart, until the point was reached where, for many practical purposes, the gods, at least, were the same. This transformation took place mainly in the 4th and 3rd centuries BC, the same period during which, as we've seen, Rome was keen to maintain the goodwill of the Greeks and was adopting a softly approach. Moving in when a crisis arose, settling affairs, and then withdrawing. As a long-term strategy, it left much to be desired. As we've already seen, Rome had found herself repeatedly being drawn into Greece's local politics. In the end, her patience ran out, and she decided that the only solution was direct rule. In this lecture, we'll see what happened when the gloves came off. It's one of the darkest chapters in the history of Greco-Roman relations. Although we shouldn't think of the Romans becoming nasty overnight, international politics are always much more complicated than that. But it now became a fact that Rome's relation with the Greek world came to be based much more nakedly on Roman self-interest. A very important source for this period is the Greek historian Polybius. Polybius's dates are circa 200 to 118 BC. So he's contemporary with the events that we're going to be covering in this lecture, which go from 190 to 146. He belongs to that very small and exclusive group of writers who provide us with an account of the Romans as seen through Greek eyes. I'll have more to say about his life in a later lecture, but here I want to concentrate upon his accomplishment as a historian. He's a fascinating phenomenon, being a committed advocate for Roman supremacy in the Mediterranean. He was writing as a Greek, mainly for Greeks. His work, in 40 books, was enormously ambitious since its subject matter was the whole Mediterranean. In his own words, he set it as his task to explain how and under what kind of constitution almost the whole of the known world was conquered and came under the rule of the Romans in less than 53 years, that's to say from 220 to 167 BC. I commented on that phrase, almost the whole of the known world, before. The slight exaggeration lends grandeur to Polybius's topic, one might say. Though his work focuses mainly on political and military affairs, it also includes a fascinating discussion of both the Republican Constitution and the Roman army. It forms the core of his explanation for Rome's success, and that's because Polybius saw the Roman Republic as exemplifying an ideal balance between monarchy in the form of the consuls, aristocracy in the form of the Senate, and democracy, the comitia or assembly. Polybius was the first Greek historian to have access to Roman sources and to use Roman eyewitnesses. He called his history pragmatiki historiae, pragmatic history. What he meant by this was something quite modern. It meant consulting original documents, talking to eyewitnesses wherever possible, being critical in his use of sources, gaining first-hand knowledge of topography, and bringing to his writing his own informed personal experience of war and politics. Early on in his history, Polybius writes, "A good man should love his friends and his country, and he should identify with their hatreds and with their friendships. But once he commits himself to writing history, he must give up everything of that sort. For if history is deprived of the truth, all that remains is an idle and useless tale." Stirring words which every historian should heed, and perhaps indicative of some special pleading on Polybius's part in that he did what few, if any, Greeks ever did, which was to adopt a Roman perspective. But back now to our historical account. We're going to turn first to Macedon. Let's recall that the Romans defeated Philip V of Macedon in 197. Subsequently, Philip managed to avoid any further hostilities with the Romans and was able to rebuild Macedon, both economically and to an extent militarily. Even so, the Romans were deeply suspicious of his intentions, fearful that he was extending his influence in the Balkans. And when he died in 179 BC, relations between Rome and Macedon quickly worsened. In part, this was due to the personality of his successor, Perseus. Perseus was never popular with the Romans. They'd hoped his younger brother would succeed, but Perseus had had him executed for treason. And though he renewed the treaty with Rome that his father had signed, his imperialistic ambitions soon began to alarm the Romans. So in 172 BC, the Senate decided to eliminate him. Livy would have us believe that this was the first time that something underhand crept into Roman foreign policy. He tells us that a Roman embassy to Perseus managed to trick him into agreeing to a truce just at a time when he had superior military resources, just so that they could catch up with him. He puts the speech, doubtless invented, into the mouths of what he calls the elder senators, who see this as a sad decline in Roman standards of conducting war. Our ancestors, they said, did not pride themselves on cunning more than valour. It was their custom to declare war before waging it, sometimes even giving the enemy notice of the time and place where they would fight. This is Roman scrupulousness, unlike the cunning of the Carthaginians or the deviousness of the Greeks, who pride themselves more on deceiving the enemy than they do on overcoming him by force. The characterization of the Greeks as devious tells us much about the way they were regarded in Livy's day. It's a topic we'll investigate in a later lecture. The idea that the Romans had never been devious ever before is, of course, a patent falsehood. But it indicates that they did, at least with hindsight, acknowledge that by 172 BC, at the latest, they were acting in a way that was inconsistent with the traditional values that they espoused or claimed to espouse. It was the price, one might say, of becoming an imperial power. The Third Macedonian War, as it is called, broke out in 171 BC. Perseus won the first battle and sued for peace. As one ancient historian has put it, he'd have done much better to lose, for this merely made the Romans more intransigent. Still adopting the softly-softly approach, still eager, it seems, to secure the goodwill of the Greeks, the Romans made diplomatic appeals to the Achaeans and the Aetolians to get them on their side, but without much success. The states that constituted the Achaean League were located in the northern Peloponnese, whereas those that made up the Aetolian League were situated in central Greece. They had constituted themselves into leagues as buffers against Macedonian expansionism. In the end, the Romans didn't need either of them. The consul Lucius Aemilius Paulus defeated Perseus at Pydna in southern Macedonia in 168 BC. It's said that 20,000 Macedonians were slaughtered. Perseus escaped, but was captured soon after. He was displayed in triumph and died a few years later in prison in Italy. Nothing illustrates better that the Romans were now in command of the entire Mediterranean than a famous story that is told about the Seleucid king Antiochus IV Epiphanes, the God made manifest, the name means. Antiochus had grand designs. He wanted not only to reconstitute the Seleucid Empire, but also to take over Egypt. The Seleucids, you'll recall, had lost territory as a result of the Peace of Apamea in 188. They'd not been permitted to move north of the Taurus Mountains. So now, Antiochus wanted to take over the kingdom of the Ptolemies. It reminds us how unstable the kingdoms of the successors were and how ambitious were their kings. Antiochus was just on the point of attacking the kingdom when the following event took place, just a few weeks after the Battle of Pydna. Polybius tells us that as he was advancing to Pelusium, a city at the eastern edge of Egypt's Nile Delta, he was met by a Roman commander called Gaius Popilius Linus. He writes, "After the king had greeted him from some distance and held out his right hand to him, Popilius proffered a tablet to him, which contained the decree of the Senate. When the king had read it, he said that he wanted to consult with his friends, whereupon Popilius did something extremely offensive and insulting. Happening to have a vine stick in his hand, he drew a circle around Antiochus and ordered him to give his answer to the tablet before he stepped out of the circle. The king was taken aback by his imperious demeanor. But after a few minutes' hesitation, he replied that he would do whatever the Romans demanded. Then Popilius and his aides took his hand and greeted him warmly. Well, true or not, it's a great story. And one can just see the Romans saying to one another, that's the way to treat one of those jumped-up Johnnies claiming to be a big-shot king. 168 BC is a fateful year, since it effectively marked the end of Greek independence, even though, as Fergus Miller has put it, no one told them that. Henceforth, Rome would conspire to quell all forms of resistance to her domination. Extreme brutality became the norm. A year after the Battle of Pydna, in 167, Roman ambassadors arrived in Achaia to inform the people that 1,000 of their citizens were to be deported to Italy, among them the historian Polybius. This was punishment for the lukewarm support that the Achaeans had given the Romans in their war against Perseus. Others were deported to Rome from other states. In Aetolia, 550 leading men were murdered in cold blood. But a far worse fate was reserved for Epirus, which had actually supported Macedon. Epirus, you'll recall, was in northwest Greece. The Roman Senate decreed that no fewer than 70 towns were to be plundered. To destruction, they now added deceit. When the Roman commander, Lucius Aemilius Paulus, passed through Epirus on his way back to Italy, he announced that its people were to be free. He then ordered that all the gold and silver which they owned should be heaped up in the public squares, evidently to suggest restitution of sorts. Then, at the fourth hour of the day, as Livy reports with chilling precision, say around 10 o'clock in the morning, he gave his soldiers the signal to sack the towns of Epirus. Each cavalryman received 400 denarii and each infantryman 200 denarii for his labours. 150,000 men, women and children were led away into slavery. Numbers are always problematic in ancient sources, but we need hardly doubt that Epirus was severely depopulated and became impoverished. The walls of all the towns were razed to the ground. The Romans had truly arrived. Yet another casualty of the war was the island of Rhodes in the eastern Aegean. During the wars against Philip V and Antiochus III, Rhodes had been a faithful ally of Rome. In the war against Perseus, however, it had suffered considerable economic hardship. As a result, a popular faction arose which had succeeded in ousting the ruling pro-Roman oligarchy that previously held power on the island. Then, when the Third Macedonian War ended in Rome's favour, the Rhodians did an about-turn and the pro-Roman oligarchy returned to power. Livy reports that when the Rhodian embassy appeared before the Roman Senate to plead that their former status as allies be reinstated, they, I quote, prostrated themselves and waved olive branches, a haunting image of subjection on the part of an erstwhile ally. Well, the Romans didn't destroy Rhodes, but they found a way to get the knife in, which effectively sounded its death knell, if you'll pardon the mixed metaphor. First, they deprived the islanders of the territories that had been granted them after the wars with Antiochus III. And second, more important, they handed the control of Delos, an island in the Cyclades, over to the Athenians, who had supported them in the Third Macedonian War. The inhabitants of Delos were expelled and replaced by Athenian settlers who retained their citizenship as Athenians. Formerly, transit trade in the Aegean had passed through Rhodes. Now it was cheaper, as well as more direct, for it to pass through Delos, which, among other things, became the most important centre for the extremely lucrative and growing slave trade. Compelled to enter into an unequal alliance with Rome, Rhodes lost not only its role as a major Mediterranean power, but also its political importance. An unintended consequence, however, was that piracy, which had been kept under check by the Rhodians because they had the resources to maintain a sizable fleet, now began to flourish again in the eastern Mediterranean. Rome would herself suffer greatly at the hands of pirates over the next century, until 67 BC, when Pompey succeeded in greatly reducing the menace. It wasn't just ambassadors that felt the need to humble themselves in the presence of the Romans. Polybius reports much the same in the case of a potentate called Prusias II of Bithynia, when he presented himself before the Roman Senate. Bithynia was a region in northwest Asia Minor, not entirely Greek, but with a heavy Greek influence. He writes, "The king bowed his head to the ground in adoration of the senators, greeting them with the words, 'Hail, O Saviour gods,' thereby making it impossible for anyone to exceed him in deference, effeminacy, and servility." He concludes, "As he showed himself to be utterly contemptible, he received a favourable answer to his request." So, that was the way for a king to do business with the Romans. So, to what do we attribute this sudden change in foreign policy from what I've called the velvet glove to the iron fist? I think there were lots of reasons. First, the Romans had grown impatient with the endless recurrence of uprisings and insurgences. They had grown tired of the constant reiteration of freedom and self-determination that fueled every petty squabble. Second, Greece had become a testing ground for ambitious career politicians and soldiers who sought to make a name for themselves by undertaking profitable foreign wars. And third, the Romans had come to realize that Greece offered an abundant supply of slave labor at a time when there was an increasing need for slaves to work the large landed estates of the aristocracy. The reasons for this are complex, but they had much to do with the fact that the Roman peasantry were having to devote more and more of their time to campaigning abroad, so that when they returned home, their farms were often in poor condition, with the result that they would sell up and move to the city, which meant that big estates, owned by the very wealthy, latifundia, they were called, were increasing. At the conclusion of the Third Macedonian War, the Macedonian monarchy was abolished, and the kingdom was divided into four nominally independent republics. It seems that Rome, even at this point, was still reluctant to assume direct control. The four republics were to act completely independently of each other, even to the extent that intermarriage between their citizens was forbidden. They were, in effect, sealed off from one another. It was hardly a long-lasting solution. We know practically nothing about what happened over the next 20 years, other than the fact that between 165 and 150 BC, the Achaeans sent no fewer than 5 embassies to Rome, politely requesting the return of the detainees. The Romans eventually conceded to their request in 150, by which time fewer than 300 of the original 1,000 were still alive. The following year, a pretender to the Macedonian throne called Andriscus appeared, or in Polybius's imaginative wording, fell from the sky. Interesting phrase. After sustaining an initial defeat, the Romans defeated Andriscus and peace was restored. This time, they didn't leave. The final showdown took place between Rome and the Achaean League. What prompted the war was the fact that the Achaeans had expelled cities that were adopting a pro-Roman stance from their league. One of these cities was Sparta. So war was declared, in Polybius's words, nominally against Sparta, but in reality against Rome. Well, what was Sparta's gripe with the Achaean League? In 195 BC, the year that marks the final extinction of Sparta's military significance, she had been forced to join the League. Half a century later, with Rome to back her, Sparta saw her chance to get even. It's yet another instance in the long list of internecine squabbles between the Greeks, resulting in the detriment of the Greek world overall. In 146 BC, the Roman consul Lucius Mummius was dispatched to Greece and declared war against the Achaeans. The Achaeans happened to be holding a meeting at Corinth, the most important city in the League. They were swiftly defeated, and the Senate decreed that Corinth should be sacked. Most of the men were killed, the women and children sold into slavery. The city was sacked, burned, razed to the ground. The most valuable artworks were brought to Rome. Stories circulated of soldiers playing dice on the surfaces of masterpieces of Greek art. The Romans even plundered the graves for the highly prized Corinthian metalware buried in them. I'd like to just pause and take stock at this moment. It's all too easy to see this as just one more act of brutality. Brutal it was, but this act must have rocked the foundations of the Greek world. Corinth, after all, was the star of Greece, as a Hellenistic epigrammatist called Polystratus put it. She was one of the most important and prosperous city-states. Her wealth derived from her position at the Isthmus, which is named after her, providing access to the Adriatic in the west and the Aegean in the east, as well as commanding the only land route from the Peloponnese to central and northern Greece. It was Corinth that probably invented the so-called Doric order of architecture, the earliest evidence for which is the Temple of Apollo, which dates to the mid-6th century BC. The terms Doric, Ionic, and Corinthian, as applied to the three principal orders of Greek architecture, by the way, are somewhat misleading. The Corinthian order of architecture was not developed in Corinth and has no real relationship with the city. The destruction of Corinth signaled that the Romans didn't give a damn about all that pompous talk about Greece being the cradle of civilization, not when it came to teaching the Greeks a lesson about the wages of disloyalty to the Roman state. We've come a very long way in under 50 years since Flamininus's declaration of Greek independence in 196. Incidentally, 3 months earlier, the Romans destroyed Carthage, their most deadly enemy. Such was their hatred and fear that they decreed that it was an accursed act to settle on its soil hereafter. Macedonia was reduced to the status of a province and had to accept a Roman governor. The rest of mainland Greece would succumb soon afterwards. So what were the consequences of this? I want to mention 6 points. First, in terms of Greek-Greek relations, it meant that centuries of pointless internal squabbling and civil strife had finally come to an end. With the exception of the rebellion led by Mithridates of Pontus in the 80s BC, which we'll talk about in the next lecture, peace would essentially prevail until the fall of the Roman Empire. Virtually, the only adjustment that would be made to the administrative organization of Greece was made by Augustus in 27 BC when he established the separate province of Achaia. This new province in the south incorporated central Greece, the Peloponnese, and the Cyclades, and was administered by Corinth, which by then had been rebuilt. Henceforth, Greek cities would flourish accordingly as they found favour with the Roman authorities. Second, on the political level, all the existing confederacies were broken up. The democratic institutions upon which Greece prided itself were either disbanded or neutered, and aristocracies were set up in their place. These aristocracies could confidently be expected to do the bidding of the Romans, A, because they benefited most by cooperating with the Romans, and B, because they had the most to lose if they didn't perform as expected. Third, on the personal level, it seems that the Greeks had to watch their tongues. We don't know much about this, but here's what Polybius has to say about a Roman embassy that visited the Peloponnese in 170. He writes, "The ambassadors indicated in their speeches that they knew who were those in each city who were not being as cooperative as they should, as well as those who were rushing forward to help." Did the Romans have their spies? That seems to be the tenor of what Polybius is saying. Nothing formal, there was no need for that, but there would always have been some Greeks, I suspect, who could be leaned upon, who were only too happy to peach on their fellow citizens for the proverbial 30 pieces of silver. Whatever the precise way in which it manifested itself, Roman domination was now an accepted fact of life, and the city of Rome became extremely wealthy as a result of all the plunder, including human plunder, that she took from Greece. Fourth, on the broader international level, the year 146 also marked the end of a kind of fractious political status quo that existed from the moment of the establishment of the Hellenistic kingdoms following the death of Alexander the Great, and one might even argue from long before that. All that now changed. Rome had made it abundantly clear that there were no steps that she was not prepared to take in the name of achieving political stability on her terms. Fifth, there is the enormous cost in human suffering that the Roman conquest entailed. Scholars differ as to how much the Romans profited from all the wars that we've been talking about in this lecture, but there can be no doubt that it made a huge difference to their economy. And it didn't end with the establishment of peace, since the cities that had fought against Rome were required to pay annual tribute. As a consequence, the Hellenistic world that Rome had now inherited became increasingly impoverished and increasingly depopulated, a topic to which we will return in a later lecture. The situation didn't substantially change until the establishment of the Principate under Augustus, which saw a gradual upturn in the fortunes of the Greek world. And finally, sixth, the year 146 marks the era when Hellenism began to make its huge inroads into Roman culture and society, largely through the influx of Greek slaves into Rome. In Horace's famous words, "Greece the captive made her savage victor captive." This was the greatest plus in favour of the Roman conquest, even though Greece's impact had already begun to make itself felt centuries earlier. But that impact would now increase both in intensity and in variety, not least as a result of the huge influx of Greek slaves into Roman households. To conclude, the period from 190 to 146 BC saw a sea change in Rome's attitude towards the Greek world. The subjugation of Macedonia, the emasculation of the Seleucid king, Antiochus IV, the deportation of 1,000 Achaeans to Rome, the sack of Epirus, the reduction of Rhodes, the destruction of Corinth, virtually everywhere you looked, the Romans were stamping their heavy footprint on the Greeks. What did the Greeks in general think about it all? Somewhat ironically, we have only the testimony of Polybius to go on, and Polybius, as we've seen, was pro-Roman. We now enter a very different kind of Greek Dark Age, very different from its predecessor. We enter a period when our sources will predominantly be Roman, though not a single of the surviving Roman sources for this period raises any protest about Rome's barbaric treatment of the Greeks. In the next lecture, we're going to trace the dying embers of Greek independence as we reach the year 31 BC, when every Greek speaker, no matter where he was living in the Mediterranean, was forced to acknowledge his subservience to Rome. And to do that, we're going to look at the last Hellenistic dynasts. Dinosaurs, one might say, who didn't quite get the point that Rome was now the only game in the Mediterranean.